Thank you, Maggie. Thank you all for coming. I want to give context for why I think what Adam is and what he talks about is so important. There's a whole public conversation about wealth inequality, social justice, economic justice. There's all kinds of programs. I was a member of the War on Poverty in the 60s, so that war has been going a long time. There's also a great conversation about Black Lives Matter, about the end of racism, the existence of racism, Jim Crow, modern Jim. So all these conversations are swirling around us. Most of the work on economic justice has been a failure, as far as I can tell. That we've declared this war on poverty, and now it's growing. The middle class is disappearing and getting thinner. We're constantly asked, are your children going to be as well off as you are? We're not sure. And so I draw from that that the way we're thinking about wealth, poverty, the way we're thinking about people on the margin, the way we think about racism, that whatever way we're thinking about it isn't enough. It's not strong enough, clear enough, powerful enough. And so if we just keep advocating more programs, I don't think anything's going to change, even though every single program has a worthwhile intention and does good work and is worth sustaining. And so when I hear Adam, and with Adam, and the way he frames the questions of slavery, the way he frames the conversation of Jubilee, the way he talks about consumerism, it's a modern religion. And here's a theologian. Adam's a theologian. It's Zayter. I just find his language and thinking takes me somewhere. It opens my heart and opens my mind. And so, Adam, I'm thrilled to have you. Much of what we'll be talking about are contained in two videos where I interviewed Adam, and they're 8 and 10 minutes long, and they can be found on the Abundant Community website. So, well, Adam, welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Where would you like to start? Do you have any sense of where a good beginning would be, or would you like me to aim us?
That was a great introduction to kind of our contemporary landscape. And I think, maybe a good place to start was just like, what stories are we telling ourselves? Like, what is the framing story in which we find ourselves in? And I think we find ourselves in, if we look at our kind of political situation, in a narrative of decline, that all of our politicians, they're talking about the decline of what's happening here in terms of the loss of power in the United States, either economic, political, even the Western world is in a narrative of decline. And the context of that, caring about the poor, is very difficult because, our civic culture is pierced through, is saturated with fear and mistrust. And it's very difficult to and if you're in an alternative community that's trying to raise the question of how shall we live together, right? Like what are the best kind of forms of arrangements and organizations to kind of arrangements to live together? It's a frightening thought because the instinct with fear is to go tribal. It's to kind of my group, and to really think of a vision to unite us in ways that are healthy and holistic is a very challenging countercultural thing to do. And I think this is where Jubilee comes in, is an attempt to try to be a ray of light that pierces through the darkness of fear.
Wow, that's a beautiful beginning. So let's follow your instincts. I like the question you have, which probably frames your work, if not your life, is how should we live together?
Yeah.
And then how do we unite us in a way that pierces this frame of fear and scarcity? And you're saying Jubilee is a light on that. Why don't you describe your notion of Jubilee?
Yeah, well, Jubilee is a biblical metaphor that's really kind of begins in the Old Testament, and it talks about, it's a period of economic redistribution where slaves are set free, land is returned to its original owners, and debts are forgiven. And those are the kind of three central points of Jubilee: being set free, land returned, and forgiven debt. And in kind of the Jubilee circle, the focus has been more on the kind of debt forgiveness part of it. And I should add also, if you're talking scripturally, starts out in the Old Testament, but Jesus picks it up and actually expands the concept of Jubilee in the New Testament by discussing how Jubilee is not just something that happens once periodically, but we should be in a perpetual Jubilee. It was originally thought to be reenacted once every 50 years, but Jesus re-envisions it as a perpetual Jubilee, that we should proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. So the question becomes, how is God calling us toward new communal possibilities, right, where solidarity with hurting and marginalized people is the litmus test for the world we're trying to bring into being, right, which is shot through with compassion. But it's a really challenging moment to have that type of language. And part of our challenge is really trying to craft the public language to bring this together and also, practice the certain type of values that would lead us more to rely on one another than to be against one another.
So I love that. We are in the business of crafting a public language to bring us together. And that's a great insight. We're not in the business of starting more programs, investing more money, getting better measurement, better management, all that. That's what we've been doing. So
yeah, I like your because you've been a veteran for such a long time. You realize that a lot of those options are pretty historically exhausted. Like we have to think bigger. We have to think cosmic,
yeah,
and not just kind of parochial.
Yeah, I like that. Historically exhausted. It makes them a little bit more noble than my experience. I just think it doesn't work. If history is exhausted, then we got to let go of it.
Yeah.
Come back to, I'm interested in your ideas about today's world, slaves set free. Talk a little bit about what that means to you and how you think about what that would look like now, because we're in the 400th anniversary of slavery coming up in 3 years.
Right. Yeah.
What does that take you? The idea that if we say, okay, we want to set the slaves free today, where would that take your thinking?
Well, just to set a context, the whole idea of Jubilee, I think, was lifted from Pastor Damon Lynch's sermon where he talked about in 1619 was the year he marked the kind of narrative origin points when African people were taken to the United States through slavery. And then he was thinking, what's going to happen in 2019, right? Like, that's 400 years, so we should proclaim that the year of Jubilee. So in terms of that, we're talking about kind of freedom from oppression, and specifically racial oppression, right, in the Black community, if we're talking about it from that standpoint. But, oppression is multidimensional, right? It's not just racial oppression. It's also economic oppression. It's also psychological oppression. It's also this. So one of the things I introduced in some of our Jubilee forums is for us to think more, depthly and seriously about economic oppression, and specifically not just about trying to make money, but about the ideology. And I called it kind of consumerism, the ideology of consumerism, how that impacts the way we are oppressed. And that Jubilee should be around, or how do we think? I guess it's more of a challenge than kind of a solution, but how do we think about Jubilee in light of the consumerism, or some people might call it a neoliberal ideology, or kind of free market idea, which to me functions not just as an ideology on a political level, but as a religious, that I even went so far as to call it the new religion, or probably the most dominant religion in the world, because it's not just production and exchange. If we talk about consumerism, we're talking about, you know, how human beings produce meaning for their lives, how they produce their ultimate values, and the certain types of belief systems that we have with consumerism, and the certain types of historical, you know, dispositions we actually function upon. So when I think about that, that it functions like as a religious, as a kind of something that even is more dominant than Christianity and Islam in terms of that, because mm-hmm. the grand narrative about the meaning of history, right? It posits a certain type of godlike functions like the market god, which is enshrouded in mystery and has reverence and has certain types of priests that come out at the Federal Reserve and everybody listens to it in terms of that. That these are the centers of value and meaning of our culture. And we need to really kind of lay our kind of critical focus on how that operates to kind of enslave all of us.
Is there a particular form or way it infects or enters the Black community?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, there are specific ways. I mean, let me start with kind of a grander thing and then get specifically the Black community. It's just those of us who study this know that our practices, our consumption, are not sustainable, meaning that we're exhausting all of our resources, we're exhausting the ecology, the planet, and that if we keep consuming at this level, we're not going to really have a viable planet. And our practices, our consumption are related to what some refer to as the politics of disposability, meaning that that if for us to maintain the certain levels of wealth and power in our side of the world means that we have to make other people on the other side of the world our community disposable, because we are going to extract for this. So
that's a powerful idea.
Yeah. So if we really are talking about a new set of values where each one is sacred, then we have to really try to undermine this politics of disposability in which our practices lend toward, right? So in the Black community, I think that what's happened, especially with after the Civil Rights Movement, that a lot of the focus has been on just trying to lift the barriers so that African Americans could be on par with whites, right? You want parity.
Right.
But what has not happened is the critique of what whites are doing enough, that even their models are not healthy models to sustain. So that's even happening in the developing world. Like what's happening with China and all these other types of emerging nations, like they're trying to follow them as a model. So we need a new model, though. Like the critique hasn't gone far enough. And I'm talking about kind of the mainstream critique. There's also been people on the radical margins who have like made these type of critiques before this and have been, sustaining that. But most of the dominant thinking has been about parity, that if we all it's been trying to, kind of keep up with the Joneses. They're ahead, that they have two cars, we have two cars. They have a bigger house, they get a swimming pool, we got to get a swimming pool. So, but no one has really, we haven't sufficiently, that's probably a better way of saying it, we haven't sufficiently critiqued the very paradigm.
I love it.
Which started. And that's where we need to do some new thinking. We need to think of more healthy paradise for human life.
That's beautiful. So, we don't realize that Jones no longer have a car in their garage and a chicken in their pot and living the middle class life.
Right.
And basically,
right.
We say, you want to live up with the Jones family? Well, the Jones are in trouble. And
right.
What I was thinking, in slavery, which began as an economic venture. You know, what was extracted from African Americans was free labor. And you say every time you extract from the people on the other side, you know, our viability, our way of living then is dependent on some people being poor, on free labor, free minerals, you know, tax breaks on moving to town. And what you're saying is equality is no longer a viable goal, that we have to stop the extraction process, which means we have to, you know, the politics of disposability is what you're trying to do something about.
Right.
So, and that's an important conversation, especially when you say we're crafting a public language, and you talk on a tape about, you know, who tells the story of history. And the priests now are very... So talk a little bit... So this is about place set free. Tell me about the land is restored. What comes to your mind when we talk about, you know, welcoming back in and restoring the land that people once had? Where does that take you?
Yeah, that's a kind of an interesting, that's a very radical point. I guess what I think about, especially from an African-American perspective, is the kind of, I guess, subdued conversations about reparations, but people don't like to say reparations because they see it, you know, even, you know, a lot of people on the left, because they see it as a divisive issue. So let's just talk about, you know, repair, you know, because reparations.
Repair, mate, that's good.
Yeah, let's talk about how do we, you know, justice as repair. You know, not just as Eva Stevens, but how do we repair? Because what happened, you know, Malcolm X, whose birthday was just noted, you know, a couple of weeks ago, said, look, if a man sticks a knife into my back 9 inches and I pull it out 6 inches, that's not progress, right? Progress is taking all the way out my back, mending the wound, bringing me back to wholeness and health. And kind of the parable of the kind of the African American situation is that, yeah, the knife has been lifted a little bit, but it still hasn't been repaired, right? So that if you talk about, you know, going back to the Jubilee concept of the original owners, is that to me that talks about a certain type of, you know, acknowledgement of the wound and a repair of that wound, and to think about that not just in terms of verbally but also materially. Like, how do we materially repair the wounds that we've caused? So that to me would be kind of a modern translation of a return to the owners.
That triggers in me that, you know, in the Old Testament, land was the productive asset. It wasn't literally an acre. And to me, when I think of land as returned, it's ownership. It's the phrase helping people have an economic ownership of the economic assets of a neighborhood. And so what I can imagine is how literally I'm going to give you land. It doesn't literally mean I'm going to write you a check. It's just that if we want to create some kind of, do something about our economic condition, we have to distribute ownership. And there's ways to do that. There's cooperative kind of ownership. There's communal ownership. There's all kinds of trust. I mean, this could be done collectively. It's not just saying to somebody, okay, here's some land for you. The land in today's world is really entrepreneurial possibility, enterprise.
Right.
So you begin to own things instead of you tell your turn.
I agree. Well, first, let me just say this in terms of the context of this. There is no repayment for what happened to African Americans. There's no amount of money. There's no amount of resources. So let me just start with that in terms of that. Like, that the type of life lost, the treasure, the ideas, in Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, which is a good read, he uses the term plunder to talk about that. He says that one of the things that people, like, mistake about segregation, they think segregation was just separation, racial separation. But it wasn't just separation. It was separation to plunder a community. And plunder is a kind of an analytical concept they use throughout the text to really talk about what's happened, like you're extracting resources for centuries, not just during slavery, but during segregation and during redlining districts, and also take it for the communities. And then we just marked over the Memorial Day weekend also the noting of Black Wall Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma, where you had a split Black community that was actually bombed by whites because of a lot of jealousy and envy that were going on there, that you could never get that back. All that kind of intergenerational wealth that was just destroyed through just looting and, you know, taking airplanes. And this is 1921. It's the first American city, you know, that was ever bombed by other Americans. It's a Black city. So my point being is that there's not going to be enough material resources to totally appear. So we're talking about an approximation. Reinhold Niebuhr said there's two things. There's perfect justice and there's relative justice. And what we're talking about here is that we can't reach perfect justice, so we have to talk about relative, at least approximate what might happen. So I think your idea about control, economic control, is a good one. It's a helpful way to try to get there in terms of what does it look like in 2016 to control the resources of your own community? How can we actually start that? And that's where we need some thinking about how to implement that.
And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to aggregate some capital, use it for loans, and aim it at the uncollateralized.
Right.
And that's the eventual part of our community. It's not all African-American. It's Appalachian. It's Latino. It's say, why don't we help that population gain control over their own economic lives?
Right.
Also, I'm tying together what you just said, which are kind of dramatic acts of plunder, but I think the religion called the consumer economy is almost more powerful, because it's less dramatic, but you're saying it's a form of plunder also, aren't you?
Yeah, it certainly is. It's certainly based upon that, right? Like it's like we're not. I mean, think about we talk about the Native. We haven't mentioned the Native Americans, right? Which is really talking about. But there's so many historical silences, right?
I know.
In terms of
that's,
like what we're
that's not even so.
right. So I think the fact that the story that we have to have a new. I mean, this is where story becomes really important. Like the story that we tell ourselves. Like we're telling ourselves. Story, like kind of make America great again, right? Like as a, that's an appeal to a certain type of power, a loss of power, and we need to have that. But there's it's based on a kind of mythological notion of American innocence, right? That America is innocent and therefore it strives to be good and powerful based on innocence, but it silences a certain bloody history that precedes the great development. And part of what's happening now where you have so many different voices who are coming in, who are becoming public, is that all these different types of people, communities, are starting to say that, look, we want to be included in the narrative. Right? We want to be publicly acknowledged. So therefore you have this. I mean, sometimes people reduce it to like just political correctness or identity politics and that type of thing. And there's certainly, you know, some misuses of that, but also what's really being screamed for is saying a story that includes all of us, right? Like there needs to be that, because what happens is that people's names aren't recognized within the narrative, then they don't feel part of the collective whole.
They're not visible. They're treated as problems that need to be fixed.
Right.
You know, in the tapes, you talk about omnipotence and omnipresence. I think those are powerful ideas. I want to talk a little longer, and then we'll invite people listening into the conversation. Let me give you some things, notes I took from your tapes that I just found fascinating. So one is the omnipotence, omnipresence. The other is that the Bible, in a sense, is really how real estate, you know, it's a real estate document. And then... say something about that. I just, you know, you say something like that, and I think I know it's true, and I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, what I was talking about how how religion, how consumerism is a religion, and how it posits a market God that is omnipotent, meaning that it defines what is real. It has the power to make something out of nothing, just like any monotheistic faith. Therefore, anything can be bought has a sticker price: air, water, land, bodies, souls, minds, right? Right? So it can talk about real. They also can talk with unreal. Like if your story, again, the market guy can say your story is unreal because there's no value in it, right? There's no material value. So it could silence people as well. So that's what that's one of the things about the omnipotence of this thing, and omnipresent, meaning that it's not, you know, historically religions are attached to a sense of place, a sacred place. Like if you go, you know, Christianity is in Jerusalem and Mecca.
Yeah, everybody's homeland. Right.
Right. But, you know, what's so kind of, you know, remarkable about the consumer religion is that it's not attached to any place. It's all over that. Any place is interchangeable, so that it really prefers homogenized global culture. Because particularity is inconvenient. So therefore, like, Cincinnati is going to look like Cleveland, and Cleveland is going to look like Columbus, and Columbus is going to look like Chicago. Like, everything's going to look the same because all the malls are going to be the same, all the chain stores are going to be the same. So that the religion is something that thrives in homogenizing global culture, and that it doesn't allow for distinction. And also, it punishes people. It can excommunicate you, right? Like things like North Korea can be excommunicated from the idea of global culture, or like Iran if it doesn't follow the agreement. So
builds a wall.
Yes, it builds a wall. It can like lock you out through policy. All these international agreements. Finally, your last point about real estate. There's a fancy name for communion in kind of theological parlance. It's called transubstantiation, right? It's kind of like a big word, but all that means is that when you take communion, the wine and the bread become vehicles for the holy, right? Like the wine and the bread within Christianity are seen as vehicles to express what's holy. And what I said in terms of the way the market religion functions as a religion is that land becomes a vehicle for what's holy in the market religion, which is real estate, property. So that land... is not like it becomes sacred in the market economy way, meaning it becomes property, real estate. Value independent of that.
That's so powerful. The other thing, and I want to stop in a second, but you said in the commodification, everywhere you go is the same. There is no place that has a memory or an identity. In a way, it's comfort, it's Holiday Inn saying, you know, come to us, because every Holiday Inn is exactly the same.
Yes.
And you said particularity, uniqueness, identity is inconvenient. Powerful thought. Let me pause here for a second, because Maggie, how about inviting people in to make comments on the chat or to call in?
Sure. Yes, we would love to hear what you're thinking and your reactions and any questions you have for Adam or for Peter. You can write those into the chat window, or if you've dialed in, you can press *8 on your phone, and I will acknowledge that you've called in and invite you in for the into the conversation.
All right, so *8, give us a call. I've got another question for Adam while people are either chatting in or calling in. Another thing I thought was powerful, and this is where I think race doesn't matter. It says we act as if spending is a means to happiness. And you think part of the religion, part of our being seduced, is that now the consumer world has defined what constitutes happiness, or even happiness as a worthy goal. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, consumerism as a way of life is a goal that becomes personal happiness and pleasure, right? Like, so the goal is personal happiness and pleasure is like the goal. So it promotes the belief that ownership of things require spending money. So that to be happy, you have to spend. So you're in a constant kind of practice activity of consumerism, even and there's really, you know, no end to this. Like, there's no limit to how much consumption. There's no upper end to it.
Well, there's no such thing as customer satisfaction.
Yeah.
Every moment that I buy something, I go home and I say, I want another one or a bigger one.
Right. It's because the activity itself. It's not the thing itself. It's the activity of consumption, which is being defined right here.
You're constantly
anxious about the next, the more. And we don't see that as a modern disease. It's like a disease of affluence. It's a disease of the more. And we're never happy. We're never happy. So, and we need like kind of pills or all these recreations to offset this kind of disappointment and unhappiness with this. And we don't realize we're caught in a certain thing. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't work for us, really. And that's what the real whole thing is, that these stories that we tell ourselves that we're caught in, they don't make us safe or happy. Right, like they really don't, and they kind of devalue, you know, our traditional institutions and our traditional ways of kind of looking at our ancient wisdom. Like, I'm at a university, and universities used to be a place to kind of cultivate human beings and think, but now they become, you know, if you ask a student like, why did you come to college, they'll say to get a job. So they treat the university like it's a job placement program, not as a place to cultivate the intellect and the soul, right? So we don't have that sensibility anymore, and it's getting less and less a place. Like, they just, earning a degree is more important than learning itself, you know. And it's kind of fearful because you have people who have the ability and the means to go to college, but the kind of dominant, you know, consumer ideology they have is that, you know, idea of success in making it has really little to do with how much you learn or how much you grow. It has to do with how much you have.
Maybe the big issue of college debt isn't that the young people have so much debt. It's just that they didn't feel they got anything of value for it, and can't find a job. If I go to college to get a job, you know, it wasn't there. And even though they're still advertising. Now, if somebody has a question, Adam, let me read this. It says, can you address community as being simply anthropocentric? In what ways is place grounded in our connection to the non-human as also community?
Wow, that's a very good question.
That's why I gave it to you.
I think we do have to expand our idea of community, especially in light of our kind of ecological degradation, and really think about, ecology in the way that we are interconnected. The Pope just came out, last June, I think, came out with an encyclical talking about our common home. And he calls for a new integral ecology, meaning that we cannot survive thinking of our lives apart from the ecological world. They are inseparably related.
Mm-hmm.
And African thought they call it the community of life, that we have to think of life as communal in orientation, and that we have to think about the interrelatedness of all things, not just all humans, in terms of that. And that's a big, you know, picture, kind of macro view of things. And what's happening now is that our sensibilities run just so counter, and our culture runs so counter to that sense. it's very difficult to have people who, I'll take one example. We don't even know what real food is anymore, right? Like even what we eat. If I give people the difference between like orange juice and like, you know, from a carton and the fresh squeezed orange juice, like a kid, they won't know the difference, or grape juice or anything like that. Like we don't know. So what happens is that we're so much into process. We're so much into kind of the spectacle of vision that we don't have real encounters with each other and with our and with nature. So I think part of what we need to do is have real encounters. We don't encounter each other. We encounter each other through screens, through this. We don't even have face-to-face encounters with people anymore. So our capacity for encounter has been degraded. And part of what we need to do is to have real encounters. And that's what our educational and religious institutions need to work on.
That's great. Thank you. Let me ask Maggie, is anybody in line to call or talk to us, hopefully?
Not yet, Peter, but several have joined on the telephone. So I'd like to just mention, if you would like to talk to Adam and to Peter, please press *8 on your phone, and I can unmute you. Thank you.
That would be great. And, you know, you don't need a question. You can just have a thought or what strikes you about this conversation, anything. It's just if your voice with *8 joins us, it will take us in a direction that would be helpful for everybody. So that's my request.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to keep on things that are striking me until we get some more comments.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you're saying is that the consumer ideology, without customer satisfaction, with the commodification of land, it's a question of what are we fighting for?
And I'm
just going to say some things, and you pick up on them. Let's hold this for a minute, because we do have one person calling. Maggie, can you put them on?
Sure.
Can you hear me?
Hello, Peter. We hear you.
Welcome.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear us?
Yeah, this is Peter Kirstenbaum here. You can hear me?
Yes.
Okay. The comment I wanted to make is the general atmosphere of this conversation. I think that we are dealing here with an individual whose focus his soul is somewhere else besides himself. It's on another human being. And I think to go around in the world, not just looking at yourself, not just being concerned with yourself, but to being actually focused on someone else or on people in general, is an unusual experience. It's the opposite of consumerism. And it's in a feeling that pervades all of these conversations. And I think it is it's a place to come to get some comfort, you might say, to feel heard, to feel acknowledged as a human being. There's somebody there who cares about somebody else. That feeling of focusing on the other, on the dialogue with another human being, is a marvelous experience that is pervasive in all of these conversations. And it is like going to another country and feeling at home. So may I contribute that? Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Again, you want to reflect on that, Adam?
Yeah. I think we are too self-focused. And I think one of the challenges is to, you know, Pedro Arrupe, who was a superior general of the Jesuits, talked about that what the challenges of our kind of contemporary world is to be a person for others. Right, like it's not that we're a person for ourselves, but be a person for our others. And even in the Bible, it's about love God and neighbor. They are interlinked. Matter of fact, we show how much we love God through love for neighbor, right? Which takes us out of our kind of narcissistic focus on self. And really takes us to like caring for the other. So, you know, I think those sensibilities are really within our traditions, but they're they're countercultural sensibilities, right? They're not the dominant sensibilities of our culture. And that's part of what we have the forums and we have these kind of institutions is to form these counter scripts, which are certain spaces where we could develop and cultivate these new models of community. And hopefully that when we start, you know, having these contrast communities, you know, at a kind of a micro level, that, you know, we could keep forming like a critical critical culture, which can transform the dominant culture in of itself. But we need to start where we are and not worry about or not be overly concerned about what other people are not doing, but just focus on what we are going to do.
Yeah, and do together. Maggie informs me there's another call. Why don't we put them on, Maggie?
Sure. Hi, and welcome.
Hi, Adam. It's Kelly Prather. I really enjoyed the conversation. And in terms of consumerism, I think that, you know, my reference point with anything I normally do is that less is more. Unfortunately, you know, when you think about consumerism, we're living in an era where, you know, individuals are looking at more, you know, instead of less. You know, they just want to consume, and they're never happy. You know, no matter how much they acquire, it's still not enough. So, you know, I do believe that less is still more, even though, you know, we're dealing with the issues that we're dealing with. And in terms of individuals who have to be acknowledged and upfront, I apologize if the background is a little noisy. I am in a beauty salon, but in terms of having to be noticed all the time, I believe that the individuals who do more work are actually the ones who work behind the scenes. And the faces who are in the public, those are the individuals who, you know, who just have to have the acknowledgement. But unfortunately, they're not doing the work. So I think that if we focus on selfless and community more, then we'll be better overall. But I did really enjoy the conversation, so I just wanted to offer that comment.
Are you a Kelly? We go to church together, Kelly?
Yes, we go to church together.
Oh, okay. I couldn't hear the last name. It was a little clear. How you doing, Kelly?
I'm well. So I'm here, and I listen to every minute of what you and Peter say. You two are my favorite. You're two of my favorite people. So
I appreciate that.
Thanks, Kelly.
You're welcome.
So she's got a name for your next book, you know, Selfless Community More.
Selfless.
Yeah, that reflections that you have on what Kelly said.
Oh, you know, I think Kelly is right on point. I mean, this seems to be a running theme. And it's actually not just a theme in our contemporary world. This is an ancient theme that goes back to the kind of the origins of especially in our modern society. I mean, part of this happens when the break with the modern, you know, I don't want to get so academic, but there's a guy named Rene Descartes. I think,
yeah.
Therefore I am, right? Like the Cartesian model of what a human being is, that a human being is primarily thought, right? So that reduction of our humanity to what we think, not what we feel or not other kind of sensibilities, but the thinking has been that everything is subordinate to reason, right? So that all of the kind of the Western thinking has been about the idea of enlightened self-interest, right?
Yeah.
Like it's rational to go into to follow your self-interest. And there is a certain type of common sense logic to that throughout all of kind of Western development through this model of Adam Smith, the economic models, the political models. But now we're coming to a point where that's being historically exhausted, and we're starting to realize that we live in scarcity. We live with lots of limitations, and we need to think about how are we going to live together in a way without killing each other. Like the idea of enlightened self-interest has not really reduced the problem of war and violence in a way that was originally thought. And we need kind of new kind of framing stories. And one possible model came with King about the story of beloved community, right? He based on the biblical idea of the kingdom of God. What's the kingdom of God going to look like in the modern culture? Well, King had this metaphor about beloved community, that we need to support not just associations between people, but loving relationships between people. You know, that most of our modern freedoms are defined by not so much freedom to do something, but freedom from something. But the idea is, once we get free from something, what are we going to do? And the idea was to be, you know, for King was about to be more loving toward our neighbors, being more loving toward our individuals. And loving is not just kind of a personal sentiment where you have to feel good about everybody. That's impossible. But what he meant by this was more a kind of relational aspect. He meant agape love, meaning God's love. I'm going to be loving toward my neighbor because of God's love toward them. That means be respectful. That means be honest. That means be truthful. That means actually be fair and generous and that kind of thing. But it doesn't always have to mean that you have to have some type of personal good feeling. And I think that's what gets us stuck, that we have this kind of romantic notion about that.
But well, we get trapped in ideas of charity and philanthropy. You know, I think
certainly.
That's why economics of compassion, the Jubilee forums, things we're doing, want to bring an economic dimension of what a beloved community is about. And a beloved community is where everybody has some control over their economic lives and participates in the economy. And that's just
mm-hmm.
never happened. There's one other idea. I know when Walter Brueggemann talks about the Jews took them 400 years to go swimming or cross the river, part of it is they couldn't imagine an alternative world. And I know you comment on the slavery of the imagination. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I'll bring you back to kind of a biblical story. In Exodus, once Moses took the Hebrews out of kind of the slavery of Pharaoh, we started to realize when they were in the wilderness is that it wasn't just that Pharaoh externally enslaved them, that Egypt wasn't just something they ran from. Egypt was in them. So it took them 40 years in the wilderness to actually get to their promised land because empire was still a part of them. And what happens during any type of certain type of slavery is that we underestimate the psychological weight of being a slave for so long. So that the idea that's happening now, we live in a world where it's easier to imagine what a nuclear disaster looks like than it is to imagine the end of capitalism, right, or consumerism. We can't even imagine what that would look like, right? So we're in a place now where it's harder, especially if you're on the progressive side, to kind of imagine what an alternative, a viable alternative would look like, that it is the matter of the end of existence itself. And that's because we don't really have, like, prominent resources that are spurring our imagination to think in alternative ways. So the kind of slavery that's so depthful is not the external change on us, which is, you know, bad enough, but it's really the kind of moral, spiritual change on our heart and soul.
So we have one more caller, and then we're getting near the end. But Mika, why don't you, if you're there, why don't you speak to us? Maggie, we have somebody on.
I did. I just unmuted. Hello?
Hello.
Sorry. Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So my comment is just about the idea of the cooperative economics. And if anyone can speak to the basic concept of something like how a community blends works in our community. And I know Xavier, I think, had something to do with that. And so if these are successful models, how can we duplicate more of those?
Exactly. I think that's a great question. I do think in terms of saying how do we help the people on the margin have an ownership stake in their communities, the cooperative model is very realistic. And Adam, you have some thoughts about that?
Yeah, I missed the first part of her question. She said something about cooperative that was kind of muzzled by my head.
Yeah, the idea of just cooperative economics. And I know that there's, for example, Community Blends, which is right on Montgomery Road in Evanston. And if you could just speak to how that concept works.
Wow, you know, you're, I think Peter's much stronger on the specifics, but in general, like the idea, you know, of wealth sharing you know, is something that's both like something, you know, in the Bible, I like to tell people, like in the Bible, you know, preachers like to say 10%, give 10% of, you know, for tithing, that type of thing. But actually, if you look at the New Testament community Acts, it was all of their possessions. They were trying to form a new community, not just like form a quote-unquote church. So the idea of wealth sharing has been like a kind of deep biblical principle, and Jubilee kind of fits in line with that. But in terms of our modern day kind of thinking about wealth, you know, Peter, I think you're much more familiar with like community blend and those kind and those co-ops than I am.
I think I would tie that to the slavery of the imagination. And we think if we're going to help people on the margin, we need to do it through charity, through philanthropy. We need to lift them up. I want to imagine a world where poverty and poor are no longer in our vocabulary. Because what you said earlier, I was thinking, you know, we not only commodify real estate, but we also commodify people when we describe them according to their average annual income.
Right.
Never to call or think of people as being poor again, because as soon as I use that word, it means they're broken. It means they failed in the consumer world. And I think you're a whole different thing. Thank you, Mika. We have to close now, but I want to ask you, help us with one more word, which is repentance, because I think the way you think about that is very valuable, and then we'll be done. Could you do that, Adam?
Yes, I will. You know, the way I think about it is that the starting point for any type of radical change has to start with a deep repentance, the kind of acknowledgement. And repentance is not so much just feeling sorry, but it's a turning away from, right? We have to acknowledge where we're at, that we have not been doing all the things we should be doing to kind of create the community that would be well-pleasing. So that repentance is an acknowledgement of that, and also a turning away from those practices and trying to turn towards something bigger, beautiful, and more grander that we want and deserve. So that repentance to me is the starting point of transformation. You know, in the Bible, they talk about discipleship. And discipleship, all that means is a learning of a way of life. Like, you know, most of us are disciples of the consumer, of the religion of consumerism. Like, we've learned this type of way of life, and we've learned it very well. What's the next way of life that we're going to be discipled into? Right? Mm-hmm. Like, in terms of Christianity, we talk about the kingdom of God, or we talk about beloved community. Are we going to be discipled into it? It's not something that is just natural, we're just kind of born, or we have instincts for it. We have to be discipled into that. You know, we need people who are going to be models and leaders and exemplars of that we need to lift up in order to enter into a new story. And that's why we have, like, leaders and sages and people and models to do that. And, you know, we don't have to do it all at once, but I think, you know, from mustard seeds spring new ways of life. We need to be thankful for the mustard seed and not be discouraged by looking for the big project.
So I would just reinforce that by saying I think the new models are all around us. We just have to find them. It's not like we have to even invent them. And I think the discipleship for today could be just to look around and find those models that are imaginative alternatives. And they're right there. I want to thank you, Adam, with one specific thing I'm grateful for that I also heard, and that is I like your kind of action plan. Mm. And your action for you is to think on these things.
Mm.
And I think what you do is you activate and shift our thinking in the way you frame things almost offhand, or someone on a small scale. And I just think that's a great gift. And I thank you so much for this time together.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, Maggie, why don't you complete us?
Sure. Well, I think my reaction is, wow. I've got pages of notes from this conversation, and it was quite stimulating. And one of the things that I'm taking away from this is about real encounters with each other. That's very meaningful to me. So, Adam, thank you. We appreciate your taking the time to be with us today. And well, I'd also like to thank our listeners and callers. There was some reference to the Jubilee Forums in Cincinnati. If you'd like to see more about that, we've got some recordings on the website, www.restore-commons.com. And we hope you'll join us again next time, which is going to be August 9, with Priscilla Kokorin, former mayor of Branch, Newfoundland, who will talk about discovering the assets of a small town. So until then, please visit our website, www.abundantcommunity.com, and stay in touch with us. And today, we've enjoyed this conversation, and we look forward to the future ones. So this brings our program to a close, and thank you for joining us.